great. Beauty.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Third Degree Burn. I am here with our typical group. We have, clockwise, we have Nigel Spink.
Hello.
Brian Hughes.
Hey there.
And flying solo, we have Fred West.
Hi, everyone.
Hey, it's Fred.
It's Fred. Fred.
Say hi, everyone.
Hey, everyone.
John is working in the garden, is he not?
He's out dealing with the winter debris.
Oh.
They have winter debris in San Diego?
It's a hard job.
California winter.
Yeah. Texas winter's fun too. We were like 12 degrees yesterday, and today we're up in the 60s.
Ooh. That's Texas weather for you.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, tonight we are going to be covering two more issues of Alpha Flight. We are going to be covering issue 4 and issue 5. And I believe Nigel has issue 4 and Kirk has issue 5.
Oh, hold on a second here. You know, I missed the last episode. I'm sorry. Just too much going on. And you guys, you know, there was things in there that you were just kind of like glossing over that I just, you know. Now, number one, which book it was, but the Moab comment. Because the Moab that was on the blocks, and you guys were thinking it had to do with Moab, Utah. I think correct. It was probably more along the lines of mother of all bombs. Or massive ordnance air blast. That's just, you know, my take on that. But, you know, just looking at that, I was like, wow. And I had to look up Alexander Muddy. I didn't realize that was a Robert Wagner TV role from A Takes a Thief.
Look, Al, I'm not asking you to spy. I'm just asking you to steal.
Let me get this straight, Noah. You want me to steal?
For Uncle Sam, you understand. As long as you keep stealing, you stay out of jail. Ironic, isn't it?
Oh, I didn't catch either.
Yeah, and then there was Robert Servet. Did you guys catch that reference there?
No,
I don't remember it.
He is like he's like the poet of the Yukon. I mean, that's how he was referred to, the Canadian Kipling. Hmm. But the funny thing is like he was John Byrne before John Byrne was John Byrne. But going back to, you know, we're talking about Robert Service. Robert Service was basically tagged as the poet of the Yukon or the Canadian Kipling. Mm-hmm. Now he's, again, a writer and a poet. But what he shares with John Byrne is the fact that they were both born in the UK and that they emigrated to Canada during the course of their life. And they were all around the place, but you know, wound up there for a good portion of time. In his case, he stayed there for the majority of his life. And so it was just a reference that Byrne had made in there, trying to see, I guess, if anybody's catching those deep cuts, because that is kind of a deep cut. Mm. The other thing, of course, was you guys were talking about Tim Hortons and whether Tim Hortons was a thing back then. Now, Tim Hortons has been around since 1964, so it's been around for 60 years.
Tim Horton Donuts have baked up another fresh idea. Introducing Strawberry Tim Tarts, a flaky tart shell brimming with rich, smooth custard nestled with fresh glazed strawberries. Tim Horton Donuts, fresh from your friend along the way.
But it was really in the late 90s, I think, where they made their name change, and I think Ron Joyce got out of the picture after he married his daughter, Horton's daughter, I think. But anyway, that being said, yeah, Tim Hortons has been around for a long, long time. You could get Tim Bits a long time ago. So
there's not that known here in the States.
No. No. And they're starting to spread into the States, though.
I've always said why there's not one in Vegas. You think they would have one on the Strip, and that would be a touristy spot.
I think they just should put it right next to Fat Burger and on the other side, Angioplasty Clinic. But that's, they could put that's it, just they my could, opinion. I could
well, they could put it by the Heart Attack Grill, which is over by Fremont Street.
Ooh. Yeah, we did get some feedback on Facebook from our last episode.
What did we get?
Well, I mean, Kirk was talking a lot about it, like he wasn't on the show. Was Kirk not on the show?
He was on. He was last week. He was on the last episode.
Yeah, he was on. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. He actually says this. He says, as I think I said in the show, I was anticipating that she was going to get her vengeance on the master when he underestimated her savagery, but it turns out that I was wrong. And then he says, interesting that you should choose the image of Marina spread eagle over the dissecting pit. Mm. That image has always bothered me quite a bit, as it should, due to her exposed vulnerability. Now, it's interesting because we had someone else on, Tony Lockhart Benson, who he responded, I've read all Byrne I could find in the 80s. Afterwards, I noticed all the bondage images that went over my head as a kid. Look at the X-Men issues when they were held by the Hellfire Club, for example. Now, of course, I think all that Hellfire Club decadence and everything was something that Claremont had come up with, wasn't it? Or was that something that the two of them just did together over the phone?
I don't know how much Claremont would have, and as for the look of the book, if he might have instructed Byrne to do things a certain way.
Well, the whole thing about those, you know, secret clubs in New York, and like the Hellfire Club's supposed to be one of them, and you know they're wearing that decadent kind of clothing. It makes me think of the movie Underworld, you know, the vampire movie.
Mm-hmm. I think it's more like Eyes Wide Shut. That sort of.
Yeah,
I never watched that movie. Yeah. But I mean, that being said, when you sit there and you look at the work of Byrne beyond, you know, that and the things that were happening in that that last issue, I can't think of, I mean, I think of Next Men. What's her name? The character, the one that is invulnerable. Is it Bethany? I always get characters mixed up on that. And she had kind of an almost bondage edge to her. And I guess that goes along with that hard-edged attitude, since that she was invulnerable and she also really didn't feel much.
Mm-hmm.
So she was trapped inside of her own body, kind of, in that way. But was there anything else that Byrne did that struck you as kind of a bondage-y thing? So, the question that I had, Nick, was there really, I mean, do you guys recall any kind of bondage fetish in this stuff? I mean, again, when you're dealing with the comic book world, there's kind of an edge to it that kind of leak over.
Not so much in this. Like, when I was reading it, I was just like, okay, well, these are weird outfits these people are wearing, but, you know, whatever. And I didn't really put the whole bondage thing into it, you know, back in the 80s, you know, kind of thing. But there is a history of it in comic books. I mean, look at the early Wonder Woman stuff.
Well, yeah, that's kind of all about
Yeah, you know, I mean, and I just wonder how much they were like, let's put it in and see if anyone says anything. I mean, if it was published today, I guarantee there would be outcry about it. But this was the 80s, and we weren't even
bondage.
Yeah, because, you know, you made a comment about her being spread eagle.
Yes.
And
yes, okay.
Yeah, and then another listener had made a comment about bondage going all the way back to the Hellfire Club. And I don't know if he was trying to insinuate that, you know, that Byrne's got a thing for bondage. But we're just kind of, well, you know, he had it here in Next Men, but it's not really big anywhere else. And so, Fred was talking about that with us, and he didn't get a chance to finish his thought, I don't think.
I was just going to say, if the scenes of bondage were published today, I think there'd be a larger outcry than there was in the 80s when this was originally published. I think it was still too much subculture. It was too deep in the subculture in the 80s that it wasn't necessarily playing on everything. But now that there's a Victoria's Secret in every mall, and, you know, and we're more evolved, and Eyes Wide Shut has been out for years now, we're a little more cognizant of what bondage is and consent and stuff like that. And I don't think we'd see images like that now.
Well, and I think it's just, it goes back to that is when you display, whether it's male or female in that position, they're vulnerable. And that's the idea. It's to show her being absolutely at the mercy of the master. And I think that's just, I mean, that image goes back, you know, as far as people were doing art. So I think that's just something, I don't think there was necessarily anything kinky to say involved.
Yeah.
What Byrne was doing. I mean, I think he's just trying to show that she's at his mercy.
Right. We got more of that with Burt Ward on the Batman TV series in the 60s. He was tied up every other week.
Yeah, true.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean, that was it as far as, you know, the feedback that we got. And I was pleased that we did get some feedback. It seemed like it just wasn't happening that often, but we're getting a little bit more, you know, when you do something that's in that sweet spot of the Byrne runs from the 70s to the late 80s, we get a lot more coverage amongst all the Facebook groups that we can post episodes on. And so we're more likely going to get feedback on something like that. Now, Chris Bywater had asked what Arctic is. I guess somebody had mentioned the Arctic or Antarctic and might have mispronounced it, but I didn't catch it when I was listening.
No,
to it.
And I corrected that. That was my spelling mistake when I
wrote
the little summary up and I put it on Facebook. I misspelled Arctic, so he was kind of pointing that out, and I changed.
Oh, okay. Well, that was nice of him. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
All righty, and that was only one out of thousands of people that saw that. So hey, that's good. What's next?
I think let's get into it. I know we're kind of on a time constraint, so let's get into issue four with Nigel.
Yeah. Okay. So as you say, we're going to look at Alpha Flight number 4 today, which is continuing with the story. First of all, I'll just go quickly through other publications for November of 1983. So as well as Alpha Flight 4, Byrne did the cover art to Daredevil number 200. He was the penciler and Terry Austin inked the cover.
Oh, that's a great cover too.
Yeah,
with where Bullseye, Daredevil is standing over the dead body of Bullseye.
Well, is he dead? Oh, okay.
That neck is twisted so far.
Yeah, I know. That's a bit of but
it's just wish fulfillment kind of thing.
Yeah. The Thing, number 5, he was the writer on that one. Ohotmu, number 11, was the latest issue of that, which covered Subterraneans to Ursa Major. So Byrne probably had one or two characters he'd drawn in that particular issue. And Fantastic Four, number 260, on which he was the writer, artist, of course. And I left that until last because this comes into a connection with the Alpha Flight story that we've got. So just as a quick recap for where we were, as most of you know, the end of issue 3, we saw that Marina had been sort of drawn to the Arctic by some irresistible calling and had met up with a strange guy calling himself the Master, who was living in like an ancient spaceship that had crashed on Earth ages ago and had kind of become part of the ice and the land there. It had merged with everything. And he captured her and started to torture her, and as well as telling her that she was actually an alien who had come from this ship originally, and that basically he wanted to wipe out those aliens. So he was about to torture her to death, it seems, when at the last minute in comes the Submariner and the Invisible Girl saying, "No, you're not going to kill her." And it's like, whoa, where did they come from? And that was the end of issue 3. To find out more about where or how the Submariner and Invisible Girl got into this story, you had to pick up Fantastic Four number 260. And yeah, I'll carry on. So FF 260. You had to read that to find out about how Namor and the Invisible Girl had got into this Alpha Flight story. So I'm going to start the synopsis when I do by going back through the parts of Fantastic Four 260 that relate to this story. First of all, let's have a look. Alpha Flight 4 we're looking at with a cover date of November 1983, on sale for 60 cents, or UK 25 pence, Canada 75 cents. And the team was, as usual, John Byrne, writer, penciler and inker. Colorist Andy Yanchus. Letterer was Rick Parker. And there's two editors for this one, Denny O'Neill and Linda Grant. Right, so I will start by giving you the synopsis that I have written with the parts from Fantastic Four, number 260, first of all. So, Namor the Submariner flies down low over the Arctic Sea of northern Canada. He scans the land below looking for detail in the uniformity of the ice floes. He does not find anything unusual, but considers the events of the day before, when many hundreds of undersea barbarians came to Atlantis seeking shelter and claiming that their Arctic waters had become unlivable. Seeking answers, Namor has come to the frigid Arctic waters and now dives below the surface to continue his quest. At first, he detects nothing, but suddenly his wristbands start dissolving. He feels weak as his strength drains from his body. All goes dark, and he sinks to the frozen ocean floor. A few hours into the future, at the Baxter Building, on the 32nd floor of the Fantastic Four's headquarters, Sue Richards helps the Silver Surfer into the infirmary and allows him to rest following his cosmic battle with Terax. Sue then looks for Reed on the residential level, but quickly realizes he is not in the headquarters. Even the lasagna Sue left in the oven for him is still cold. Before Sue can phone Avengers Mansion, where Reed was supposed to be working, she is interrupted by a wet and greatly weakened Submariner who begs her for help. Okay, now I'll move on to the synopsis for Alpha Flight 4, which is the title of this is Resolutions. I'm using the Marvel Wiki synopsis mainly, but I've added some other parts simply because, for some reason, the person who wrote this, whenever Snowbird appeared in it, they seemed to think that that wasn't worth mentioning. So, here we go. The Submariner and the Invisible Girl race towards the frozen north in the Fantastic Four's Fantastica. Namor expresses concern that a great evil lies within the territory that has been poisoning Atlantean waters and driving barbarian hordes farther south. Suddenly, a laser array protrudes from a patch of ice and blasts the ship out of the sky. About 3.5 miles away, a great white bear turns towards the blast in the sky. The bear is outside an entrance to the master's lair. And slowly the beast changes, reverting back to the form of Snowbird. Though she feels the evil in this place, she senses her teammates are within, and she must join them. Meanwhile, Guardians succeed in finding Aurora. However, the experience has traumatized her, and she's regressed into her Jean Marie persona. Jean Marie rejects her fellow Alphans and takes off into another corridor. Sasquatch feels that he might be able to reach Jean Marie in his human guise, so he shapeshifts back into the form of Walter Lankowski. He catches up to her, and in an attempt to calm her down, recalls a secret past intimacy. But Jean Marie grows enraged and backhands him across the face. Vindicator, meanwhile, flies down an alternate route until he meets up with North Star, who is only now reviving from an attack by the Master's ship. Namor and the Invisible Girl escape the destruction of the Fantastica and land on the ice below. Namor rips open the ice and they dive into the waters, Sue surrounded by her invisible force bubble. Just as Namor begins to weaken, the Submariner and the Invisible Girl eventually find an undersea entranceway into the Master's craft. Sue turns them both invisible, and they find the Master of the World standing above the prostrate form of Marina. The Master is yet unaware of their presence, so he continues to tell Marina of her own mysterious heritage. The Master tells her that her species originated from a race of alien conquerors who abandoned their home world millennia ago. As their population expanded, they colonized new worlds, greedily consuming all of the planet's natural resources until it was time to move on again. 40,000 years ago, one of these alien hive ships malfunctioned and crashed on Earth in the North Pole. Drawing nutrients from the environment, the living ship grew, insinuating itself into the very fiber of the planet. It then issued forth a summoning beacon designed to attract the planet's dominant life form. From there, it would genetically copy the life form's template in an effort to breed a new conqueror species, readily adoptable or adaptable to the planet's needs. Thousands of alien spores were launched from the ship, but to the Master's knowledge, only one egg survived intact all those years, Marina's. Because her egg rested at the bottom of the sea for so long, the alien spore evolved and became amphibious. When the egg hatched, the life form inside genetically imprinted itself upon its handler, and thus Marina took on a humanoid form. Deciding that they had heard enough, the Submariner and Invisible One make themselves visible and descend into the Master's chambers. The Master operates mechanical grabs and tellers which spring from the walls to attack Namor and Sue. Recognizing that he could not hope to defeat the two heroes in addition to the wandering members of Alpha Flight, the Master elects upon a speedy retreat. He leaves behind Marina, who is being stretched to death by her confinement, when suddenly a swarm of mosquitoes enter the chamber and miraculously change into the form of Snowbird, who breaks the bonds holding Marina and carries her to safety. Vindicator, meanwhile, flies throughout the vessel, blasting as many instrument panels as he can find. The extensive damage begins to take its toll, and the ship starts to buckle. He manages to regroup with the rest of his team, as well as Namor, Sue, Marina, and Snowbird, and they start to evacuate the ship. The giant space vessel explodes, destroying a massive portion of the surrounding icy landscape. Sue protects everybody inside of an invisible force field and creates a raft for everyone to stand on. The Submariner invites Marina to come back to Atlantis with him so that they can research her alleged origins more conclusively. Marina accepts, and she says goodbye to Alpha Flight. Later, Guardian stops off in Newfoundland to tell Dan Smallwood, Marina's adoptive brother, that she is gone. Dan, who has nurtured a lifelong passion for the amphibious hero, is heartbroken. And that's the end of that particular tale.
Good job.
That was a long-winded combination there.
You were having a
job as always.
Before we get too far into it, I got a question here for Kirk, since we covered Namor ourselves, just the two of us. You notice Byrne does not draw the gills on Namor the way he did in the Namor book.
No, I didn't catch that.
Yeah, I didn't until I started reading it the second time.
Yeah, there's no gills till Namor title. Yeah,
I didn't catch that his wrist cuffs had dissolved until you mentioned it.
Yeah.
Is this the, and also, is anybody reading a scan of this, or are they reading it from a omnibus?
I'm reading the same scan you're reading, so I've got the same problem with the pages being displaced.
I found that out last week, but I fixed mine. I went and unzipped it, and then I fixed it. But I'm talking about the double page spread where Namor rips the ice apart. On the opposite page, Namor and Sue and the parts of the alien vessel are all red. Like they mixed up the plates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they are. Yeah. Well, I've got the original issue here.
So it's that way it's the same. The printing. Yeah.
Yeah, they're a very dark pinky purple. Yeah.
They fixed it in the omnibus, which I'm also looking at.
Right. Yeah, because I wondered if it was supposed to be like that because they're underwater.
Yeah.
But no, because the other page, on the opposite page, where he rips the ice out.
Pink and purple again.
There's a pinky purple background, but everything else looks to be normal colour. And even when they're underwater, the part of the Plodex ship that you can see on that page is more of an orangey sandy colour. But on the other page, as you say, it's a bright dark pink.
Mine's red. Mine's a very dark red. It's probably because whoever that flesh tone color, yellow or whatever, they when they printed it, the plates got messed up. So everything is fine. It's just everything else is just red where it should be kind of orangey.
Okay, I do have a question along the lines of Byrne as a writer. And that is in the segment where Namor and Sue are inside the vessel. They've gotten inside. Now, the page where they show up coming up out of the water. Mm-hmm. And then she turns them both invisible. Mm-hmm. Is her outfit designed in such a way that it doesn't get soaked? Because trying to walk around stealthily in a place after your whole outfit's gotten soaked in water is going to be nearly impossible.
Come on. It's unstable molecules. It probably sheds water like crazy.
And that's also why Aurora and Northstar probably can do their powers like they do with their costumes on. This is probably... I meant to mention that before about your
She's
last
got the,
episode.
The drying mode from Michael J. Fox from Back to the Future 2.
Yeah.
Remember when he gets wet?
Yeah.
Self-drying?
Drying mode on. Deck drying. Your jacket is now dry.
And you know, they come out of the water, her hair is not plastered to the side of her head in that scene, too.
Mm. Yeah.
So. Well, that's she's maybe. In a bubble. Now, she is in a bubble
she was
under
in
the
a
water.
Bubble, yeah.
But she didn't get wet.
See her hands. Yeah, her hands are touching the bubble. So,
so
maybe
she didn't get wet
after all.
Yeah, she's still in the bubble. Yeah.
They just didn't show us the bubble like they typically would do.
Yeah. It's just, it's invisible. Yeah. But
speaking of invisibility, as she is leading Namor through the ship and holds hands with him, she turns both of them invisible. Mm-hmm. That's a violation of her rules. It's either her or someone else, as established way back in FF22.
Yeah, but she's so much stronger now.
I'll give you that.
Yeah, she's advanced her use of her powers by now. Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting, and Namor comments on it, that he's unsettled when she makes them both invisible. And he says that's... Mm. No, I'm not used to it. And she said, don't worry, just
go with it.
just move naturally,
Okay, now, I don't read anything. I haven't read much of Alpha Flight after these issues.
Yeah.
Up to 28. Did they ever update her origin, or is this still her origin?
Marina?
No,
they've remained consistent through... at least up to Alpha Flight 50. I don't know that I read beyond 50, but I don't think they've ever gone back and addressed the Marina storyline.
No.
Other than what they did here.
Yeah, there's another story coming up later, so let's not talk about it anymore. there's another story in the teens involving Marina, etc. But yeah, you're right. Basically, what the master is saying here is true, as far as we know, about where she's from and everything. Yeah. One thing I did want to raise about sort of maybe mistakes with certain characters' powers is the swarm of mosquitoes that come in and change into Snowbird. Yeah. That's who it is. It's really Snowbird, and then she frees Marina. But according to the way Snowbird's shape changing works, and I've taken this from Ohotmo, it says when she takes the form of an animal or creature, whose mass and volume are less than that of a human being, she becomes a human-sized version of that animal or creature. So really, if she changed into a mosquito, she would be a person-sized mozzie. And as far as I know, she's not able to make herself into hundreds of
mosquitoes. She's a swarm here.
Yeah, and I would think the only way you could kind of no-prize that is if when mosquitoes get together in a swarm, if they have a hive mind kind of collective like Borg, then fair enough, you could claim they're kind of like one entity. But if they don't, which I don't think mosquitoes do have that, she shouldn't be able to become a swarm. She should just become a giant mosquito.
Well, now, Byrne has complained about certain things with Ohotmu over the years, and that part of that is because, you know, Mark Gruenwald was editor over that, and he had a tendency to fill in the blanks himself. If he didn't know, he didn't necessarily go to the source and say, hey, how's this going on? Mm-hmm. And so he would just come up with his own answer.
Yeah.
And
I'm going to, well, you know, yeah, maybe he never saw this. And in most cases, yeah, when she becomes a creature or an animal, it's usually just the one thing, like polar bear, Arctic owl, etc. So
she'd be a big Arctic owl too.
She's a big Arctic owl when she changes, isn't she? She's a bigger than normal Arctic owl.
Yeah, because when she becomes a Wolverine to kill the Wendigo, she's a larger than normal Wolverine.
Yeah, she's a large Wolverine.
But have you ever seen what an owl looks like without its feathers?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that would have to be one really big owl.
Yeah.
Also on her, and when you first see her and she's as a bear and she sees the explosion and she's in front of the doors.
Yeah.
And Coca-Cola.
It says it wonders in its slow bear way, you know, if this is the distant explosion in some way, you know, connected. To me, that implies that when she's in the form of a creature, I thought it was just her own intelligence. She would just look like that creature. But it sounds like she kind of takes on the attributes, like she's not quite as intelligent. She's kind of thinking like a bear.
Yeah, the longer she stays in the form of the creature, she becomes more like the creature.
The creature.
The creature's natural ways kind of slowly take over.
You remember that X-Men issue when she was the Wolverine that Logan had to talk her down.
I thought that was just like bloodlust and she was all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if she's been a polar bear for a while now, which she changed last issue, I think, when she was to blend in with the surroundings, etc. And so she's becoming a little bit more bear-like.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably why she decides to change back, amongst other things, to her human form.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, I know if she didn't turn into a swarm of mozzies, she wouldn't be able to get through the ventilation.
It wouldn't work, right?
To get in, so it had to be that way. But I thought, what? She can't turn into a swarm, can she? But I don't think she ever did it again, did she?
No.
I don't think she does it again, no.
Usually it was always the polar bear, the Arctic owl, it was always something white, usually. She turned herself into. So, I forgot that she did this, kind of thing. And I was like, okay. And then I just went along with the flow. I'm like, it seems out of canon, but, you know, it's two panels within an overarching story. I can let it go at that point.
Well, she has to be something native to Canada, right? Something that's.
That's kind of a dodgy thing, in my opinion.
There's an interesting thing in this issue, is that this is the first letters page from, you know, basically from the letters from issue one. They had, 200, over 200 letters for Alpha Flight number one, which they thought was... And they said still more was pouring in. If you actually look, if you have the scanned issue, you can see a page that shows an ad for Thor, the Walt Simonson Thor. Yeah. And they've actually printed the names of every person that wrote in up to that point. And that's on the letters page. Instead of printing any letters of, hey, this is great, I love it. a letter from T.M. Maple, or who was that guy that always wrote in to Byrne for Superman? Was it Malcolm Bourne? Because he was writing in on Marvel books at the late times of his career there in the mid-80s, you know. But that was something I'd noticed there.
Yeah, just a load of names of people writing in.
Well, Marina's, and I think I said this when we covered Alpha Flight 1, was her backstory is basically the same as the Iron Giant. She was sent here to as a destroyer, but she basically decided, no, I'm going to be good. And she's turned against her kind of her programming.
Super.
You are who you choose to be.
Superman.
That's right. You choose. But he doesn't what he tells them. You choose who you want to be.
Yeah.
So it's kind of xenomorph-like in that it adopts whatever DNA or the whatever the genetic structure, whatever it touches, kind of the way a xenomorph will take on the form of whatever it's pregnant.
Yeah, I always kind of wondered, you know, because she kind of, she disappears after this episode for a long stretch kind of thing. And it's like, I really wish there was like backstory of, you know, how do the Atlanteans accept her, knowing who she is now that she knows, you know, how is her time in Atlantis spent, you know, kind of thing would be interesting.
Mm. I mean, there are some other comics that connect to, because Submariner was in and out of the Avengers as well at this time. So, and I was reading the Avengers too. And so Marina appears in the Avengers as well around this.
Don't they get married? The not to jump the gun, but don't they get married later on?
Yes. Yeah. Because there was a crossover. There was an Avengers issue and an Alpha, something like Alpha Flight 38, 37, something like that. They got married.
Spoilers.
Let's not burn that, so it doesn't matter.
Well, it's still 40 years ago.
It's after burn. It's after burn.
Well, I think this story, and if you read this one, the next one, these early, it feels like Byrne doesn't quite know what he wants to do. He kind of jumps around, you know, she's, they've just formed the group 3 issues ago. Marina's already gone. You know, Puck is not even in this one because he got hurt in the last issue. Neither is Shaman. And
I don't think it's what you think it is, Tim. I mean, you kind of think it's like Byrne just kind of shuffling all around. I think this is him working very hard to not have the team get together, to not follow all the tropes of the team books. He's doing anything but that. And so guest stars right away. You know, he didn't wait to the 4th issue.
Well,
I mean, it was in the 4th issue, but you know, it happened, you know, previously too. But I mean, he's trying to break all the conventions. It's like the movie Unforgiven is a deconstruction of Westerns. This is a deconstruction of the superhero team book.
I will buy that. Is that his deliberately doing it just because, is it his way to silently rebel against having to do the book because he didn't want to?
Probably.
That's what I thought. Yeah. I mean, I always heard that he really resented having to do this book. And so, you know, I just felt that this is him, you know, bringing people in, killing them off, and you know, getting rid of the tropey kind of things, you know.
He didn't have to do the book. I mean, you know, he was given the first chance to do it because he's the guy that created him.
Yeah, and the right of first refusal.
Yeah. And, you know, they wanted to do the book and he refused to do the book. And then finally they say, well, we're going to get someone else to go ahead and do the book. And he's like, no, I'll do it then. Yeah. And I mean, I can understand, you know, wanting to do that because, you know, they're kind of your children.
Yeah.
Or they're your toys. And I mean, let's look at the Marvel Universe and the DC Universe as the different sandboxes that you get to play in. And all the classic characters are the toys everybody wants to play with. And especially Byrne, he loves playing with those guys. He doesn't much like playing with ones outside the toy box. And he creates some, but he doesn't really feel that great about them. So it's like, okay, let's set this one on fire and let's tie this one to a firecracker and see what happens. And, you know, that's what it seems like to me. It's, you know, playing with the toy box is what you get, you know, as opposed to what you want.
I have a different take on that.
Go ahead, Kirk.
I see this as Byrne very specifically focusing on the individual characters, beginning with the first two new ones that we know nothing about, doing in-depth stories on their characters so that it establishes them. And I think he proceeds after doing, so to speak, individuals. Then he starts doing it in dyads, in pairs, and looking at the relationship. I don't, you know, you may be right that he wanted to do anything except for the group book or the team book. But I look at the structure of this, and it's like he's going after the individuals to paint them and get you into their heads so you know who everybody is before we reach issue 12, and then we deal with the aftermath. Not to go too far with that, but that's how I approached this. That's how I looked at overall. Because, yeah, the team doesn't get together. The team isn't together. The individuals are being looked at.
Yeah. And that's a really good point.
It kind of mirrors, to your point, Kirk, it kind of mirrors what he's doing in, for the most part, in the back of these issues where he's doing the origin stories, where he's telling it or he's picking origins for various characters. And you're right, he does, because the next issue is a Puck story, and then the next one after that is a Snowbird, and then we deal with Aurora, and then we get a Sasquatch solo, kind of a two issues with him, until everything kind of comes back to your point. Yeah, he is kind of getting to know, because even when we'd seen these characters in X-Men, they were just kind of surface level. We never got to know them. We just got to see them fighting. We didn't know anything about who they were. So I think he's figuring it out. He's feeling it out as he goes. And I think with any creative, you will create something and you're like, okay, maybe he started to write Maria and then just like, okay, well, I'm bored with her. I don't know where to go with her. I don't know. So I'm going to take her off the board and move on to somebody else.
Yeah, I'm going to say it doesn't take long to get rid of Marina for some reason. Yeah.
Well, I think she served his purpose.
Yeah.
His first three-part arc, and he broke Smallwood's heart. And now he set that off to the side. He's going to deal with other characters.
Yep.
Speaking of dealing with other characters, I'm watching the clock here. Are we ready to move on to Alpha Flight 5, or do folks have additional comments?
No, I think we can move on.
I'm good.
Yep.
Okay. Well, I happen to have the synopsis for Alpha Flight number 5. What a coincidence. So I'm going to tip my hat. Thank you very much to Brian for doing some additional research for me this evening. I want to give him credit for that. So this is Alpha Flight number 5, What Fools These Mortals Be, by John Byrne, creator Tom Orzechowski. Sorry, I don't know how to say that. He's the letterer. Andy Yuckas, colorist. Denny O'Neill, editor. And this is not a mistake, Jim Shoot, American. It's not Shooter, it's Shoot. Very odd. Cover price is 60 cents. It was published in, I believe, December of 1983. On sale, though, in September 13th of 1983. Page count is 32. Editor Dennis O'Neill, as we mentioned. And, of course, it's Marvel. And the synopsis goes something like this.
Did you want to give the other books that came out that month?
Please do. Do you have that information?
Yes, I do. And by the way, on my copy, it does show as Jim Shooter, American, not Shoot.
Yeah, it does.
Anyway, so December of 1983, of course, obviously we have Alpha Flight number 5. We also have Daredevil 201. Obviously, he just did the cover on that, and it was a Black Widow story. So it features her live form on the cover there. Very nice with the short hair. Then, of course, Fantastic Four 261, The Search for Reed Richards, which takes place, I guess, after last episode. Yeah, after last issue. Official Handbook of the Marvel Universe. Now, the interesting thing, now this is Valkyrie to Zax. So I think it's like the getting close to the end. But this is volume one. It's not volume two, which is the one that's my favorite. But yeah, they still like to use Byrne a lot in there. The Thing number 6, Mindscape, he was the writer on that with Ron Wilson doing the pencils. And that's what you got for December of 1983.
Thank you very much, Brian. I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. All right. I'm going to try to turn to the synopsis here. And I'll warn you at first, I somewhat use interchangeably Eugene Judd and Puck. But I'll try to identify Puck when he's in uniform as opposed to when he's not. All right, so the episode begins with a yellow cover, and you see multiple images of Puck jumping out of the corner box, rolling, tumbling, and describing a Z shape across the face of this cover, much like they used to diagram the draw the Flash.
Okay, did anyone notice that even the word Puck is hairy?
Yeah.
I never noticed that until just now.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd seen this cover before, but I'd never really given a whole lot of thought. I like how Puck comes from the little character box up at the top corner, and he does all of his gymnastics all around it. Mm-hmm. It's one of those things that Byrne got tired of doing when he was on Spider-Man and other books and working as Art Robot. They would have him doing all these different things, and he would draw it much like this. But you don't get to see a whole lot of that with many of the characters. So, yeah, interesting. Fun. Again, the hairy Puck, that's just.
I like it. All right. So the story begins with Dr. Michael Two Youngmen checking up on Eugene Judd, who is actually Puck, in the Fort Albany Hospital since he was nearly disemboweled back in issue number 2. We're in issue 5 now. Puck is healing well under his magics. All the nurses swoon over the doctor, who is well known. One, though, particularly is drawn to Judd, and she takes every chance she can to bathe him. Well, enough said about that. Once alone, Shaman asks Puck if there's anything else to be done. He offers Snowbird as a mystical contact in case he's needed. But Puck doesn't like the Ice Queen, but he says he's got the signal implant if needed. Now, Judd is popular with the nurses, as I just mentioned, but his pain returns overnight much sooner than it should, given the dose of the drug that he's on. He gets up to find out why the nurse doesn't respond to his call bell. He takes it easy, but he does find Nurse Dally in the back supply room, apparently going to shoot up. She shoos him back into bed. By morning, Judd begins to sneak around due to his small size and discovers that pain meds have been cut in half strength. He's surprised, though, by a young delivery man who picks up the meds, but he can't follow at this time. Judd reports his findings to the doctor in charge, and he asks for 48 hours to investigate further. That night, he changes into his magically repaired Puck outfit, which helps to hold his stitches in place. That night, he spots a rusty yellow van making a pickup again and rides it this time to a boathouse. From the roof of the van, he observes the handoff as one of the thugs complains about the sudden rushed pickup. Puck takes note of this. Now, he's spotted, and in a brief acrobatic encounter, he takes out the two men with relative ease, but he's torn his stitches and he's losing blood. He staggers towards a phone conveniently located on the wall, but he blacks out while trying to reach up to the phone. As he comes to, he's in the care of the head doctor, who introduces Sergeant McNamara, who thanks him for rounding up the gang that they had been working on. He explains that Puck succeeded in calling the police and convinced them he was with Alpha Flight, which is what saved him. Puck does not remember making the call, however. The doctor insists that Puck get some rest, and he warns the sergeant privately that Judd may not last the night, as he's on a wave of painkillers. The doc returns to give Judd a sedative to help him sleep, but Judd says he's not convinced that Nurse Dally was behind it all. The doctor says she was being duped by the goons. Suddenly, Judd punches the doctor as he was moving to inject Puck, grabbing the needle and vial away from him. He confirms that it was an overdose of insulin that the doctor was preparing. The doctor is the head of the drug ring, and he set up his goons to take the fall along with Nurse Dally. Judd says he'll call the sergeant at the desk to come back and pick up the rest of the garbage. Moving on now to the backup feature, which is titled Death Watch. 15 years ago, Dr. Michael Two Youngmen is confronting his ailing godfather, sorry, his ailing grandfather around a campfire that's being held in a cave. He rejects the dying old man's claim that he must abandon the white man's ways and accept his power and destiny, but he leaves. Now, his child, Elizabeth, is being cared for by a very young Heather O'Reilly, I think it's O'Reilly, their neighbor, as his wife is being examined. He learns his wife is dying of cancer. He throws himself into trying to save her and promises his child that he will save her mother, but he fails. Elizabeth rejects him then, saying he'd promised, and turns to the neighbor Riley family for comfort. Mr. Riley says to leave her in their care, as Michael has too much grief for one man to deal with. He has read that Michael's grandfather died that same day as well. Next issue, part two, The Old Ways.
Okay. So I'll tell you one thing right off the top. I guess it's page three when Puck is sitting there in the hospital bed writhing in pain. That image of his face looks just like my father-in-law who's in the next room. I'm going to take a picture of him and send him to you guys. It's scary. yeah. The other thing is all those nurses have to be on the drugs because if you look at all the nurses they got on page two, they all look thin as a rail, thinner than anyone's, you know, got any business being.
Mm-hmm. No, that the woman in with the, what looks like she's the older nurse. She's got kind of
yeah,
grayish
the one
hair.
That wants to, yeah, the one that wants to
wants
bathe,
to bathe him. She's a little full figured.
Yeah, she's a little full figured, but the rest of them look at they're just tiny. I mean, you throw a sandwich at them, they'd fall over. just my observation. Then on page four, when Puck is coming out of his room, that gives me a little flashback to The Godfather when Michael's sitting there looking down the hallway before Enzo the Baker comes in. And one other observation I have. Puck is not wearing a hospital gown. That is someone's T-shirt. If it was a hospital gown, we would have gotten flashed on page eight when he's doing all of his jumping around.
That's somebody's T-shirt. It really could be a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's just an extra large T-shirt, you know, or an XXL T-shirt.
Mm-hmm. Well, they wouldn't necessarily have a gown in his size.
Yeah.
At that hospital, unless they were treating children. And even then, I don't think it would fit. So I think
it
your explanation of a T-shirt is very good.
Yeah. Yep. Anyway, that's what I got.
I like
not
the story
much
a lot.
For having his costume magically repaired, but it's a comic book, so I'll buy it.
Well, his wounds are magically repaired, too.
Shaman's a magic user.
Yeah. Shaman's stitched up his... Well, he says he acts like he still has stitches, but he says he used his magic to accelerate it. So maybe he's more healing his internal organs because when he's fighting the guys in the when he's climbing towards the phone, you see he's leaving a trail of blood behind him. He's leaking.
Yeah,
somewhere.
I really like that.
Yeah, but the costume itself shouldn't be. I mean, it's got to be leaking down to the bottom of his costume because his costume isn't torn.
No. Leaking out, yeah, you don't see how this costume looks, so it's coming out.
There's only a certain amount that they can get away with, considering this is a Comic Code approved book. You can't really show a lot of blood and gore, but I think Byrne does an effective job of giving us black spots and black pools where necessary to your mind takes over the rest.
Yeah,
I thought that blackout scene was really cool.
Yeah,
when he's passing out, as I recall, that was on a right hand page. Not on the left, as I'm looking at in the trade. And so you don't know what's coming. You don't know what the next is.
Right, it's on page 14. And
on 15, too.
Mm. Well, on 15, he reverses it when he's coming out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wasn't sure if they were going to make something of that and say, you know, you're actually missing more of the story and come back to it. But it's okay. They don't do that. That was just me wondering if we were purposely not being told the rest of the story for some reason. That's not the case. Also, the shading of these vials that he's being injected with, or that he's supposed to be injected with, or that the nurse is working on, they all have a red stopper on it. Have you noticed?
It's a cork type material that they can get a needle through.
I had the impression that these were all colored red, except for one that had been diluted intentionally so that you could differentiate them.
Yeah. But that panel on page 16, you know, I saw the red and I was like, hey, I want to go back and check the other vials. And when you look at that label, you can see just
The
smallest little bit of the corner peeling up on it. It's like, oh, that's where that is.
Yeah,
you know, kind of thing. So,
well, that's the clue I think that either Puck picks up on.
Yeah.
Because you are kind of, because you would, just like the other one, Kirk, you said this is a right hand page. So you think, oh, he's fixing to give him the shot. You wouldn't pick up on the fact that label is peeled until in the very next page, you know, Puck is clocking the guy and grabbing his wrist so he won't inject him.
I've got to say that I really enjoyed this story, which is why I asked to synopsize it. In my memory, I thought this was issue 3, that it followed immediately behind his injury. But obviously that's not true. I really like this because it got into the head of Puck. It establishes that he's a well-rounded individual. He knows Shakespeare. He flirts with the girls. He turns out not to be a villain, but he turns out to be one of the good guys. And he solves this case pretty much all on his own. So I give him a lot of credit for establishing a strong, competent little person that really grabbed my attention. From here on out, I was a Puck fan, at least until we get to 28. Beyond that, that ain't Puck, but that's another story. Yeah. Guys, I'm going to have to leave you now. The clock is striking the bottom of the hour. I have just enough time to depart and get back to work. My lunch hour is over. So I'm going to let you continue to discuss it, and I'll see you next issue or next episode, okay?
All right.
All right. Take thanks, care. Kirk.
Guys,
see ya. Kirk.
All right.
Bye.
One thing that's funny is I was reading this issue. Oh, gosh, it was several years back. After my wife and I had gotten together, and she walked by and she goes, oh, he's a grappler. And I just kind of look at her like, what? And she goes, that guy has got a cauliflower ear. He's a grappler like those MMA fighters. And you know, it's funny. You sit there and you look at something for a long time and you don't notice these things. It's right there in front of you. And there it is. Yeah. The one ear is bent out like that. And now I'm sitting there watching like MMA with her, and they're like, yeah, look at that guy's ear. That's really messed up.
You know, it also establishes that Puck is not a kid. You know, he's older than a lot of like the younger superheroes, like John Paul and Jean Marie, Walter Lankowski. Puck, even though doesn't have gray hair, he's an older individual, you know, and this is like one of the first times where one of the newest inductees into a team is not a teenager or a 20-something. He comes across as being like a 40-year-old, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, he's got reading glasses and he's you know, to your point, Fred, he's been around the block. He's got a lot of experience. To your point, the nurses were all talking about how great he is. He said, you know, he sounds like a barroom brawler, but he's reading Shakespeare. So he's you know, he's this dichotomy of he looks like a bruiser, but he's probably well read. And when they kind of retcon when you get an origin for him later, that he is much older than even we think he is.
That's after the burn years, and I don't want to talk about that.
I didn't like that because they kind of take away of who he was. One thing I like about Puck is that there's nothing super about him. He's just a regular guy that's trained himself to be the best. He's kind of like Cap, except without the super serum. So there's nothing. Then they later give him superpowers and some other nonsense. But
now in the shaman story, the very first page of that, when you see him down at the bottom left hand corner, doesn't he look like James Hong?
Yeah,
David Lopan.
Look, we came here to see David Lopan. You have succeeded, Mr. Burton.
What, you?
I don't get this at all. Shut up, Mr. Burton. You are not brought upon this world to get it.
Yeah. A little bit.
I'm sorry. I do like the coloring and the the ominous tone of that first page, but I really want to know what kind of car that is. It looks like it would be like a Porsche. or something along those lines, but you just see the corner of it, and you don't. I think there's a
what there's is a little Corvette? Bit of it on page.
Yeah, 19. I was looking at that.
It looks like an old Corvette, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Like a 60s yeah, model Corvette.
A badge. Yeah.
And Heather's maiden name is McNeil.
Mm-hmm.
Not yeah, O'Reilly.
Kirk. Yeah, Kirk got it wrong.
Yeah. Oh, O'Neill.
And yeah. we get some more of John Byrne's patented little people children. That that last page where she's running, Elizabeth is running out, calling her dad a liar.
Mm-hmm.
That yeah. could be Puck running out of there. That is, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he doesn't, we said that. He doesn't do a good job.
Heather on page 19, when Elizabeth jumped up into her dad's arms, she yeah. looks like Velma from Scooby-Doo. It just lighter hair.
Mm-hmm. And Michael's wife on page 20, for somebody that is sick, as sick as she is, she looks great. Either she doesn't look like she's ill in any way, shape, or form as she's waiting for the doctor. You know, she's posed like a pinup model there, mm-hmm. which is just
well, looking at her the way when I saw this as I was reading through it today, especially the page 21, you can almost see a sunkenness in her eyes, like someone that's sick. You know, yeah, it's just I mean it's there, but it's very, very, very subtle.
Yeah.
Well, and are doctors known for kind of pulling their punches and not telling you how sick you are? Because the doctor doesn't tell her, and it's why he says Michael can't treat her, because then she'll know how sick she is. I don't think that's something they do, but it works in the story.
Yeah, doctors of today tell you just how bad it could possibly be.
They're usually
be.
Pretty blunt. Yeah, they'll tell you. Yeah, because they don't
want any room for a lawsuit. You know, if the person all of a sudden drops dead next day when you tell them, well, it's just a little cut, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, that went across the spleen, you know. But, yeah, no, doctors are pretty, most times, straight shooters.
Yeah.
Well, I think they have to be. But
yeah.
I love on page 21 that little, the yellow panel where they have the Alpha Flight logo, and you get yeah. that A and the F combo there at the bottom. I've seen that before in a couple other issues. I think it looks great.
Oh, yeah. Again, as you're sitting there reading these, unless you're really doing a deep dive into it, you're not catching these little subtleties.
Yeah.
And I'd never noticed that before. Boy.
Well, it's interesting. And go ahead, Fred.
I love the foreshadowing with Michael's daughter that pays off later in the run, you know, kind of thing. I like this part of the backstory. It would have been very easy to be like, oh, he's always been there. But I like this this character that is part of the Western world and resisting his native upbringing kind of thing. And I like Shaman's always been one of my favorite characters. But I like seeing this early view where he was trying to get away from the reservation and how he's called back to his family tradition, you know, kind of thing. I always like that about him.
And this is even 5 years earlier mm-hmm. than Vindicator's story.
Yeah.
I still have a hard time calling him Vindicator.
Sue kept calling him Vindicator, and the note is that she didn't know that he changed his name to Guardian.
But mm-hmm.
Is it the Val Kilmer movie Ironheart that he is an FBI guy, but he's really Native mm-hmm. American, and he kind of goes back to his reservation and kind of finds his roots kind of like this where...
Yeah.
You know, Michael is rejecting all of his past, and mm-hmm. he believes in science, and he's a doctor, and you know, he's got the short hair, he's got the business suit, and he's his father has died, and he's like, okay, that's my last tie to this life. I can move on. Mm-hmm. And his grandfather, of course, says, no, you'll be back. And then
I'm just flashing on how much it is similar to Stephen Strange.
I thought the same thing, Fred. That he rejects science the old ways, yeah.
Yeah, it really literally just flashed across my brain as I was sitting here. I'm like, wait, this is Doctor Strange, but with a Native American bend to it. Like, what?
There's a couple movies that have a similar theme to it. I'm trying to find one. Now, it's not about being the medicine man or, you know, or source or anything, but there was a Kiefer Sutherland movie with Dennis Hopper about hippies. And Kiefer Sutherland's an FBI agent trying to track down the hippie that Dennis Hopper is. And he winds up going back to his old town where his whole family and everybody were all hippies, and he'd gotten away from it.
I need women. I need drugs. I need drink. I need something, man.
It was supposed to be an ordinary prisoner transfer.
I'm a federal agent, and this man is my prisoner.
So, brother, I am just like you, a prisoner of the system.
But this...
What can I bring you?
How about a hacksaw?
Only kidding.
...was no ordinary prisoner.
I went and slipped some acid in your mineral water.
What did you say?
Hey, don't you worry. I'm not going to let you trip alone. I dropped a couple of tabs myself.
In the next 2 days, John Buckner, FBI, will have his identity stolen.
You know who you look like? You look like me.
John Buckner, FBI.
His freedom taken away.
Wait till they find out how I escaped from the feds.
His career destroyed.
John, we don't like to look foolish.
And he owes it all to one man. Huey Walker.
You know what your problem is? You like me, but you won't admit it.
20 years ago, he wanted to change the world.
It takes more than going down to your local video store and renting Easy Rider to be a rebel.
Today, he'll settle for just one guy.
They flushed my head down a toilet.
Oh, yeah, well, blame me for everything.
Dennis Hopper, Kiefer Sutherland, Flashback.
Once we get out of the 80s, the 90s are going to make the 60s look like the 50s.
And I can't seem to find the name of that one. And then there was Doc Hollywood, because he was a small town guy that got out of the small town and wound up back in one.
Yeah.
Well, if you could pull up Doc Hollywood, pull up Cars.
Oh, yeah.
Because that's a remake of that film.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a new story, but it does give us, I mean, he does kill the wife off pretty quick. She's in three or four panels and she's gone. And I think it's probably an honest reaction of a kid to react that way, to like, no, and he probably shouldn't have promised. I mean, I don't know what you would say to a kid, but you shouldn't have promised that he would
make her better.
He could make her better. But again, I don't know. I don't have kids, so I don't know. I wouldn't know what to say.
But as a doctor, like, doctors get training for that. Like, yes, he's a dad, but he's also a doctor. And as a doctor, he has to break that news to other patients, you know, kind of thing. And yes, it's his daughter and it's his wife. And yes, he's having to deal with all that grief. But at the same point, it's like, you're trained better than the average Joe, Michael, that you should have known how to handle that. You know, you're trained not to promise that you can fix everything as a doctor. Or either that, or doctor training has changed a lot more from the 80s to now.
Well, I thought when I was first reading this, because I hadn't read this in years, I thought, okay, when his doctor's colleague tells him that, oh, she's very, very sick, you can't treat her. And he says, you know, she's a woman I love, I'm going to help her. I thought, oh, he's going to go back to his grandfather. And maybe now he'll embrace the magic, thinking the magic will fix her. But he doesn't. He just reads up on it and just tries, I guess, to cure whatever she's got. It doesn't work. And then maybe that's what brings him to embrace. Because at the end, he says his grandfather died too. His wife had just died. And he says, your grandfather died
same
too.
Same day, yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably the grandfather.
We've seen the grandfather before in issues. Well, we've seen the grandfather's skull.
Right.
Before in issues. So.
Yeah, that's issue one.
Granddad's still around. I want to know where grandfather's assistant is. Like, we know what happened to granddad, right? But what happened to this assistant that he had? Wasn't he training this person to be a replacement for him, for the tribe, you know, kind of thing? So, interesting.
Well, he says it has to be blood to blood. So I guess since Michael's father is dead, he couldn't pass it to him. He can't give it to anybody, because I think Michael says, can't somebody else do this? He says, no, the old knowledge must be passed from blood to blood.
Okay.
So I don't know if he was, that's just it, is Michael, at this point, is Michael's grandfather basically a shaman now? Is he using his powers to protect Canada that Michael will later, or Michael became the shaman and thought, oh, well, I can use these powers beyond, and I can kind of mix both. He does mix the Western world and his own background and his fighting. So,
but I have a funny feeling grandpa's assistant's going to come back.
later on.
She might. I don't know. Like I said, I stopped reading. I think maybe I read up to 50. And after that, I quit.
Yeah, kind of that's like where I stopped too.
Yeah. Then I would drop back in later when they would do anniversary issues and stuff.
There's a way to find out about that. Let me take a look here real quick.
I want to actually get back in and reread up through 50 and then continue on and then go to they took a break of the title for several years and then they brought it back and kind of, I'd like to see where they take things now.
Well, at one point they killed them all off. Then they brought them back.
Yeah. Blank 7. No, they don't even name the character.
They don't name her. I look. Yeah. I'm looking in Wiki right now. They don't even name her.
Yeah. They don't even name the, shaman. Supporting characters, Ramsey McNeil, Claire McNeil, Max Basarba, Michael Tuyoungman's grandfather. They don't mention anyone else.
They're saving that. They're saving that for future episodes.
Well, unless that assistant actually happens to be his wife and, you know, she, you know, seduces him to try to get him to come back. But instead, you know, because isn't the, that was 15 years ago, him coming up driving a car. Okay, so that's around the same time. So that, no, that wouldn't be the case. All right.
Do we have any, pardon me, anything else?
Maybe that's his mother.
No, she's too young for Michael's mother.
Michael's mother? I think it's just another tribe member that's either helping out the grandfather or...
Right.
Yeah, because you know, she says help to him, I can't believe he refused you, old father. Now, I mean, you can say that to an elder, I understand, or a priest or, you know, whatever, shaman or whatever, you can call them that. But you can't tell if her hair's gray or not.
I think it was somebody the tribe had working with grandfather to take care of grandfather because he was their shaman, you know, and they would want him to train somebody to take over, you know, even though the shaman power, technically, you're right, it's blood to blood, but that doesn't mean this other person can't learn all of the stories and medicinal and the actual right shamanic duties that the tribe requires, you know, kind
it's
of
like
thing
having more than one Padawan.
Here's an interesting bit of trivia that gets thrown in there. This is the first appearance of Michael T. Youngman's grandfather. However, his disembodied skull was first seen in Alpha Flight Number 1.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anybody got anything else here?
Well, we haven't. Nigel, you've been kind of quiet on this issue. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts?
I've read this story, the Puck story, once or twice. I'm quite familiar with this one. It's a good one. Yeah. And I'd not really looked at the second story for a while, though, with the beginning of Shaman's origin, if you like. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a good reminder. Yeah, I'd forgotten that his wife dies and that we see his daughter when she was younger. Mm. Mm-hmm.
The omnibus, for some reason, they pull all these origins and put them together. They don't leave the issues intact. So when you're reading you don't get these. They're all lumped in at the beginning of the book.
Mm-hmm. At the beginning. Well, it makes sense.
It makes sense.
In a way.
But,
I mean, I was, when we first said we were going to do that, I was going to suggest at one stage that we did all the
origin
stories first. And then I thought, well, no, I suppose not, because it's going to be bitting and batting through the issues and then going back again. So. Mm-hmm.
I think John really thought about this when he put it together, because you know, somebody was saying you have to have all this exposition so that at the end of the year, at that issue 12, what happens there has to have some resonance. We have to care about people, and so getting through these things without calling them their secret origin stories, but just have this as a natural progression, makes us care about these characters that, let's be honest, in the X-Men issues, they were kind of two-dimensional, and now they're being fleshed out and they become real and we're starting to care about them, so that when we get up to the issue 12, that impact has more resonance with us.
Yeah, yep, true.
Yeah. All right, I think we can, unless we have any other comments, I think we can wrap up. I want to thank everybody for coming on and recording with us tonight. Sorry, Kirk had to leave early, but his input is always welcome. Brian, why don't you tell the folks where they can reach us?
Oh, we're everywhere. But if you want to write it, I mean, the easiest, quickest way to get us is on Facebook, in the Third Degree Burn Facebook group. But we are, you know, we post our episodes wherever we're relevant in the Facebook groups. If you want to write back to us there, provide us a little feedback, go to where you found it on Facebook and just type in your thoughts, your feelings, what you want us to know. If you want to go a little bit more old fashioned, you can write us at our email address, gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. And lastly, you can reach us at our old standby. Give us a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts, formerly iTunes. We're still working on getting our older shows back on there after their most recent glitch, but it looks like we're going to have to rebuild that feed. But it's still a place you can go in and give us a 5-star review, let everybody know how great we are. We'd really appreciate that. But that's pretty much it. Other than that, it's, you know, in the halls at work. Anyway, I hope you all really enjoyed the episode. I enjoyed talking about all this stuff, and I'm looking forward to getting into more Alpha Flight here. Fred, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
Really, really enjoy having you along and enjoy the input that you're providing. It's a breath of fresh air next to these geeks.
Okay. Well, it just proves that we don't need John. So you can just tell him that he can just stay off the show and
Fred can just come on. John is going to sit there and think about everything that Fred tells him later. And he's going to record a 5 little thing telling putting us all in our place. Uh-huh. That's what John's going to do. You tell
actually,
him.
Actually, John is out cooking dinner for us right now. So, ooh, you know.
Us? He's cooking nice. For us?
Yeah, he's cooking for me.
Oh, okay. I could freeze dry up some beef stew and send it to you.
Okay. All right. Well, I want to again thank everybody. I want to thank the listeners. If you've hung around this long, appreciate it. So for Third Degree Burn, I am Tim Elliott.
I'm Brian Hughes.
I'm Fred West.
We gotta work on that. We gotta work on that.
Yeah, I gotta work on my timing. It's still new to me, guys. I apologize.
Oh, it's all right. It's all right.
And I am Fred West.
Nigel here, signing out. Bye bye.
Good day.
Good day.
Thanks for listening. You can find us and many other great shows at tutufreaks.com. That's TWOTRUEFREAKS.com. Third Degree Burn is spelled with the number 3, RDDEGREEBYRNE, and is part of the Tutu Freaks network of shows. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Just look for Third Degree Burn, spelled with the number 3, and Burn spelled BYRNE. Compliments, complaints, and recipes can be sent to gottagetburned@gmail.com. That's gottagetburned@gmail.com. Drop us a line and tell us how we're doing. Till next time, this has been Third Degree Burn.
Some men aren't looking for anything logical, like money. They can't be bought, bullied, reasoned, or negotiated with. Some men just want to watch the world burn.